Your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you every week to discuss self-care and integrated health. Vitamin C is relatively inexpensive and very well studied. A Medline search by my guest revealed 24,000 articles in the year 2002. There are very few reported adverse reactions, and this is even in so large a sample. In the late 40s, 1940s and 1950s, there are papers describing its use in optimal megadoses given intravenously and with intramuscular injections, resolving and even curing life-threatening ailments from viruses like polio to poisonings and venoms. So we have to ask, why aren't we seeing vitamin C being used in all hospitals and emergency rooms? Is it because it's so inexpensive? Today we examine the use of vitamin C to prevent and resolve almost every kind of immune insult humans are exposed to. My guest is Dr. Thomas Levy, physician and lawyer. His book is Vitamin C, Infectious Diseases and Toxins. Dr. Levy received his Bachelor of Arts degree in biology from Johns Hopkins University in 1972. He later graduated from the Tulane University School of Medicine in 1976. Continuing his training at Tulane, he specialized first in internal medicine and then in cardiology, receiving board certification in both of these disciplines. After completing his postdoctorate training, Dr. Levy served as an assistant professor of medicine at Tulane Medical Center for another 3 years. After a private practice of adult cardiology, Dr. Levy started his research on the medical impact of dental toxicity with Dr. Hal Huggins in 1994. And in 1998, he received his law degree from the University of Denver and was subsequently admitted to practice law in Colorado in the District of Columbia. Vitamin C, Infectious Diseases and Toxins is Dr. Levy's fourth book. His previous books are Uninformed Consent, The Hidden Dangers in Dental Care, co-authored with Dr. Huggins, The Roots of Disease, Connecting Dentistry and Medicine, co-authored with, Robert Kulatz, DDS, and Optimal Nutrition for Optimal Health. If you want more information about Dr. Levy, you can look at his website at tomlevymd.com, or you can go to his other website, which, isn't right in front of me. Do you want to help me out? Peakenergy.com, which talks primarily about the dental stuff. Welcome to you. Thank you so much for making yourself available.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
What occurs to me is that we might want to start, especially since you're a lawyer now also, as well as being a physician and a researcher, let's start with why, in your opinion, vitamin C isn't more supported by conventional medicine.
Well, you know, the first part of the book addresses this and actually talks about an analogous situation in which chronic severe seizures in children are not treated with the ketogenic diet, which takes care of seizures in most of these kids very nicely, but somewhere in the 1940s, prescription medicines became available, and it's hard to imagine anything but that the it was a whole lot easier for the doctor to write a prescription and push the family and kid out the door rather than have to deal with a complex diet. But which one is obviously better for the child, a prescription medicine with some of the most pronounced side effects in any of the drugs in medicine with the anti-seizure medications such as Dilantin, or a mere adjustment of the diet? Medicine has a way of ignoring anything that's not in their textbooks.
That's right.
And so that begs the question, how do you get into the textbook?
Right.
Well, you get into the textbook by being part of the medical mainstream and being tapped on the shoulder to write the chapter. And if you, in writing that chapter, are not very enlightened and not motivated to look at research that existed past the 1990s into the 80s, 70s, 60s, 50s, and 40s, then once you've written that chapter in the textbook of medicine and not included that information, it's basically been excluded forever. And most doctors simply do not have an open mind to information that does not come to them through anything but what they consider to be their established channels.
There's also a terrible fear among doctors of being accused of malpractice, and I have to say that in many districts throughout the United States, the boards are clamping down on physicians who practice things that are not considered, quote, standard of care. You know, that's the term, unquote, that we hear, standard of care. So anybody who even suggests, you know, I'd like an IV solution of vitamin C, if the doctor's on board, the doctor's almost in danger of being taken as a quack.
Well, that was certainly the situation for quite a few years in the not-too-distant past when it came to intravenous EDTA chelation therapy.
Right.
And these therapists were routinely hounded by the boards, even though they had established scientific literature showing that their treatments were hardly quack treatments but had objective improvements in a wide variety of diseases. Vitamin C, at least to this point in time, has not been hounded nearly so badly. I'm not aware off the top of my head of anyone having been prosecuted or badgered or had their license withdrawn solely for giving vitamin C intravenously. That's not to say it's beyond what some board could do in the future, but so far that has not been a problem up to this point in time. Most doctors are much more fearful of being ostracized by their peers, if you will, being made fun of, being made light of, and that probably paralyzes the spread of modalities such as intravenous vitamin C more than anything else.
The work of Dr. Frederick Klenner, spelled K-L-E-N-N-E-R, M-D, illustrates to us with all of his experience using optimal high doses of vitamin C, that what's really important here in terms of looking at the research is that if you don't use enough vitamin C, that you will not see the kinds of results that Dr. Klenner did. Did you want to talk about some of his? Well, you might give us some. We're going to go through some in the course of talking about what it does. Of course, he'll come up again. But do you want to talk a little bit about what he was doing, especially, I guess, about polio?
Oh, absolutely. And what you said about dose is very critical, because there's probably been over 80,000-90,000 research articles on vitamin C since its discovery, and they were writing about it even before it was discovered, just as the anti-scurvy factor. It's probably been written about more than any other single entity that I can think of. But what would happen is, in the literature, they would do animal studies, human studies, test tube studies, and they might use, in some cases, 25 milligrams of vitamin C, 100 milligrams of vitamin C, 200 milligrams of vitamin C. As we'll talk during this hour, that can be as much as 1/10,000th of the proper dose. Yet when these minuscule doses wouldn't work, they wouldn't reach a conclusion in their articles that vitamin C is ineffective in these doses. They would just make the conclusion that obviously vitamin C is ineffective for this condition. And so, if you will, vitamin C has gotten a very systematic libel in the medical press for a long period of time, simply because uninformed researchers, doctors, PhDs, etc., either weren't aware of Dr. Klenner's work or just ignored it. I don't know which, but they insisted on continuing to research with incredibly small doses of vitamin C. It takes millions of units of penicillin to cure a pneumococcal pneumonia, yet nobody expects 1 or 2,000 units of penicillin to do anything. Yet that's the same sort of thing they've been doing with vitamin C. Well, Dr. Klenner probably first showed the incredible drama of what he was doing in 1948, and he published this in 1949, in the middle of a polio epidemic in North Carolina, where lots of kids were getting polio. And even though Klenner verified his diagnosis on several of these kids with spinal taps, he ultimately just made the diagnosis clinically because it was in the middle of an epidemic, but he treated 60 infants, most of them less than 1 or 2 years of age, 60 infants with polio. And he at that time would do their small body size, was giving them 1 or 2 grams, that's 1 or 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C intramuscularly, every few hours until the fever came down and the clinical condition improved. Well, he cured, and I do use the term advisedly. I know what cure means. I'm a medical doctor. He cured all 60 cases of polio within 5 days. And he cured 57 of them within 3 days, but about three of them relapsed after 3 days, and he just gave additional doses of vitamin C, and they were cured as well. There was another occasion, too, just to show you how needless a lot of this suffering with polio has been, just as one example, is there was a young girl, I think 4 or 5 or 6, an age like that. She had already had polio for a long enough period of time that she had a complete and total paralysis of her lower extremities for almost 4 days. In that setting, with that side of effect already manifest, it took a little bit longer, I think a couple weeks rather than 5 days, but Dr. Klenner was able to completely cure that little girl as well with intravenous vitamin C and no residual paralysis at all. So this is pretty mind-boggling stuff. And the questions always come up, how can it be ignored? And other than to tell you the stories that I just told you about the ketogenic diet and other therapies that don't make it in the textbook of medicine, the public will just have to figure it out for themselves. But the fact of the matter is, what we're going to talk about today is all in the literature and is continuing to be repeated on a daily basis now throughout the world.
Yeah, even though vitamin therapy, there are people constantly on the prowl trying to discredit vitamin therapy and find ways of saying that it's dangerous and not to be used and various things. The other thing that's similar to the ketogenic diet story is what was done with diabetics early on. Diabetics early on were given a similar diet. They were given a high-protein, high-fat diet, and that's what they used until the diabetic medications were created, and now they're suggesting a high-fiber, high-starch diet, so, you know, high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet, just murder for diabetics.
I wasn't aware of that, but it's a very similar situation.
Yeah, very similar. Okay, what might be interesting to talk about here is how vitamin C works in terms of the sort of energy exchange, cellular communication, and this issue of the donated electrons and the imbalance of electrons, and how people might understand this from the perspective of the sense that people have that there is electricity going through the body, because this is exactly how it works.
Well, very much so. I mean, electricity is flow of electrons, and vitamin C is one of your ultimate natural sources of electrons. Now, we hear the terms bandied about a lot called antioxidant, and vitamin C being one of the premier antioxidants. And, of course, the flip side of that coin is an oxidant, something that incorporates oxygen into it in the same way that something would rust. Oxidation basically represents a chemical reaction that's one of the early stages of the metabolic breakdown of a tissue. And it's mediated by the loss of electrons from whatever tissue or chemical substance you're looking at. If something loses electrons, it's oxidized. And in the course of becoming oxidized, it becomes either non-functional or much less functional. So the more tissue, enzymes, and parts of your body that become oxidized, the less functional they become. Well, when you have a strong antioxidant such as vitamin C, this is a electron donor. So this is available to immediately repair oxidative damage. If something has just lost its electrons and become oxidized, vitamin C is there to replenish the electrons and minimize or blunt any damage that, say, a toxin would do. Virtually all toxins are oxidants. Virtually all toxins are going to induce oxidative damage. And this is why, as amazing as it sounds, is that I researched over 100 different toxins that were mentioned in the literature along with vitamin C, and they were all partially or completely neutralized clinically and chemically by the presence of vitamin C. So you have to think of a final common denominator for a single molecule such as vitamin C to neutralize the toxicity of 100 different chemical substances. They have to ultimately do something at the end of the road that vitamin C can reverse. And this, I believe, the literature shows is the fact that toxins rob electrons out of tissues. Those tissues become oxidized, non-functional, disease states set in. And if you don't have enough agents such as vitamin C and other important antioxidants present in sizable enough doses, that oxidative electron loss damage persists, and then disease processes get worse, and then further conditions develop. But if you have enough vitamin C present early on, these diseases, these conditions, generally don't need to develop at all.
It's important also, I think, for people to understand that because we are oxygen breathers, because we use oxygen in all the processes in our body, oxidative stress occurs just by being alive. Any kind of stress, that means good stress too, like if you exercise or have a nice run on the beach or even have sex for that matter, you're still going to have some oxidative damage. And there are theories that oxidative damage is part of this rusting is part of what causes aging. So keeping the body repleted with antioxidants as primitive people did from food source was essential in primitive man, because at some point we stopped making vitamin C in our bodies, unlike some wild animals, which still do.
No, and that's absolutely correct. In being oxygen breathing animals, we incorporate oxygen into a lot of tissues, doing oxidation, as we were just talking about, but this is a specialized form of oxidation that produces energy byproducts, such as the energy coming from ATP
right,
being broken down to ADP.
Mm-hmm.
But you're quite right, too. And that is that even though this is oxidation that's being conducted for positive physiological purposes, the very state of being alive does generate oxidative stress. And this is the purpose of taking a quality diet, getting enough rest, and taking the right type of supplements so that your body is able to compensate each day for the amount of natural oxidative stress it undergoes. Obviously, when you introduce an infection or you introduce a strong toxin and you take the physiological amount of oxidative stress and increase it tenfold, a hundredfold, a thousandfold, then you can see it's quite a different animal and can rapidly become a disease process.
I just want to remind people that you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with Dr. Thomas E. Levy, L-E-V-Y, M.D. and J.D. He is a lawyer and a physician. His book, Vitamin C, Infectious Diseases and Toxins, is available from Ex Libris Press. And I will find the page with Ex Libris Press. You can go to Ex Libris, X-I-B-R-I-S.
X-L.
Oh, X-L. I'm sorry. I saw that and didn't say it. X-L-I-B-R-I-S.com to get a copy of the book if you'd like. As you say, oxidative stress, and the word stress is coming up here, is an important component of illness, because stress and illness kind of sit in the same slot in our lives. One of the things that, as I said before, since human beings no longer make vitamin C, it's interesting. I don't know if you know about this old study, but there was a study where they tested firefighters. They gave them 10,000 units of vitamin C, sent them out to do their jobs, and 2 hours later they came back and they tested their levels, and they had no vitamin C left in their bodies at all. So let's talk a bit about illness and stress and vitamin C.
Well,
I mean, in other words, what I'm trying to say is we've just explained the mechanisms here with oxidative damage, but one of the other things we might say is that vitamin C gets used up very readily and has to be repleted often.
Absolutely, and one of the primary reasons why so many infectious diseases or toxic conditions that, for example, aren't being treated vigorously with vitamin C, they rapidly induce vitamin C deficiency syndromes as part of the worsening of the disease. In other words, the longer you hang on to an infection, or the higher the dose of toxin that you're exposed to, the more the vitamin C stores in your body are used up trying to neutralize those effects. And as they get used up, you very much can induce an acute scurvy type of syndrome. And let me tell you, the last thing you want to have when you're trying to recover from a severe infection or a mercury or a lead or a cadmium poisoning or a mushroom poisoning or something along those lines is an additional acute vitamin C deficiency throughout your body. Yet this is exactly what happens to a lot of people, and this is one of the primary reasons why an infection can progress to a fatality, or a toxic exposure can progress to a a fatality is the vitamin C gets used up more quickly than it's being repleted by whatever diet they're eating. So, yes, vitamin C in and of itself can neutralize a lot of these infections, a lot of these toxic states, but if you don't take any at all, you're doing more, because by not taking any at all, the toxin or the infection will then cause a vitamin C deficiency and make everything worse. One of the things that vitamin C does, even at very low doses, is help maintain vascular integrity by building collagen and other connective tissue inside our blood vessel walls. When you become rapidly, acutely depleted of vitamin C and you effectively get an acute scurvy, you can start with a whole host of bleeding side effects. And you start bleeding because there's not enough vitamin C to give the blood vessel support with the collagen fibers and the other connective tissue. And this is why there's a large number of very rapidly progressive infections, such as Ebola virus and what's called the different African hemorrhagic fevers, etc., that finally kill by massive bleeding throughout the body. These people cough up blood, aspirate blood into their lungs, and they just die of a general bleeding throughout their body. And I'm going to tell you that final bleeding complication is because they've just about metabolized every significant molecule of vitamin C left in their body.
And the irony here is that there's all this stuff about sending antibiotics and whatnot to Africa, and really, if we just sent them just huge amounts of vitamin C and had them hydrated with this stuff, you know, it would be so much easier. It's such a crime. It's so inexpensive. Vitamin C is so cheap. Or if we weren't interfering with their diets, you know, if they were still eating their whole native diets, how much healthier and how much more vitamin C.
Exactly. Antibiotics are definitely not without their effect. Vitamin C and antibiotics can work very well together. But vitamin C needs antibiotics need an immune system to work with.
That's
so
right.
When you're looking at a starving African child who has the poorest of nutrition, an antibiotic is not going to have that much effect until you energize the immune system. Which vitamin C does in a number of ways. There's a lot of articles cited in the book that, if you'll allow me an analogy or a metaphor, the immune system is very much like an army with rifles, and the vitamin C supplies the bullets for the rifles. Okay, so the vitamin C very much arms your immune system, helps interferon to be synthesized, helps antibodies form to an immune challenge, enables antibiotics to have their effect, even in the case of vaccinations. A vaccination is further enabled in terms of antibody production by taking enough vitamin C along with it.
Well, in fact, as you say in the book, I mean, one of the things that's fabulous about this book is that it's written in such a way that a patient or physician can use this as a way to justify vitamin C usage, because all the sightings are here. You can look up an ailment or a poisoning or whatever it is, and there will be all the sightings listed here, or many of the sightings listed, that show a precedent for using the vitamin C and instructions on how to use it. So if your doctor says, oh, no, that's just never done, that's silly, it's voodoo medicine, like I heard one doctor say in a hospital setting in an emergency situation, you can arm yourself with this book and show up and say, aha, but look, here, see, and here's a sighting, and it actually happened. But more than an antioxidant, more than an antimicrobial, it is an antidote for poisoning and for pollutants and venoms. And what I'd like to do is just kind of go through a bunch of different things that are interesting about it. And one of them is, as you say, as an aid with strong medications that would otherwise be damaging, or with something like a vaccination, which could potentially be irritating, the vitamin C can mediate the damage, and also may, as we discover through the book, be substituted actually for a vaccine. But in any case, if you're going to use one, you can use it with vitamin C. It also helps with drug and treatment toxicity from chemotherapy agents and radiation, which is amazing.
Really, modern medicine kind of recoils whenever you try to generalize too many things and sort of bring too many things under one umbrella. But all of the research that I did over 3 to 4 years brought me back to the same common conclusion, and that is virtually all toxic damage is mediated by oxidative stress. And of course, vitamin C can neutralize the oxidative stress. If you're of the mind that you want to treat a cancer with chemotherapy drugs, that's fine, but the side effects that chemotherapy drugs are going to cause are virtually all caused by oxidative stress. So if you take your chemotherapy with high enough doses of vitamin C, you can optimally get the killing effect of the chemotherapy on the cancer cells while the vitamin C is there to immediately repair the damage that you're doing to the normal tissue.
Vitamin C is very good for helping to remove metals from the body. It's very good to protect people from metal exposure and toxicity, although there's some things when we start talking about safety issues with vitamin C that we'll come back to this issue. But there are things like if someone is going to have an amalgam removal and they're going to be exposed to mercury, if they are given an IV solution of vitamin C after the amalgam removal, it'll, or even during it, if you can get someone to do it, will hasten the urinary removal of the mercury. You also mentioned that psychiatric patients, this is very interesting, often are shown to be high in lead toxicity, that there's a connection between psychiatric symptoms and lead is very high in smokers. And also lead increases the amount of dental cavities that people have. And instead of throwing fluoride at them, which is another poison, vitamin C is useful here as well.
Yes, and in fact, vitamin C is an extremely effective chelator of lead. A moderate oral dose of vitamin C takes out as much lead as an intravenous dose of EDTA. And when you use the EDTA intravenously and the oral vitamin C together, you are able to take out more lead than either one doubled. So it seems to have a synergistic effect. One augments the effect of the other. But depending on the metal or depending on the toxin, vitamin C, as you mentioned, vitamin C, as you mentioned, can accelerate the excretion, but that's not always its effect. And there are a few toxins where it doesn't seem to have the effect of necessarily accelerating its excretion, but it does accelerate its breakdown into other metallic products that can be broken down. And in all of cases, whether it accelerates the excretion or not, it will certainly deal with the toxic damage that the heavy metal or whatever it is you're dealing is doing.
It's also needless to say, because it's pretty obvious by this point too, that, well, maybe not obvious, but there are cases, we're going to break in just a second here, but there are cases of just extreme poisonings, mushroom and whatever you can think of poisonings, also toxic poisonings and venom, snake bites that were treated with very fast intramuscular injections of vitamin C and a vitamin C push, where they actually saved the lives of several children and people who had been bitten. Let's take a brief sort of a 40-second or so break, and when we come back, I want to talk about some of the research with AIDS and vitamin C. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm on the phone with Dr. Thomas E. Levy, L-E-V-Y. His book, Vitamin C, Infectious Diseases and Toxins, available from Ex Libris Press. You can get it from exlibris.com. We will come back to our interview in just a moment. Stay with us.
Get weary hearing the news. It's really no news at all. It's the same old story. Brothers killing brothers. They haven't heard the news. Well, I'm so glad there's a new world coming through. Keep your mind on it. Shine your light on it. Try to make it home safe and sound. Can you imagine some place where no one wants to harm you? Well, meet me in the new world coming through.
Welcome back. Keep me up. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Thomas E. Levy, L-E-V-Y, physician and lawyer. His book, Vitamin C, Infectious Diseases and Toxins, is available from Ex Libris, spelled X-L-I-B-R-I-S, and it's exlibris.com on the web to order it, or you can go to 888-795-4274, 888-795-4274 for vitamin C, infectious diseases, and toxins. And if you miss any part of today's show and want to get a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, or if you need to get hold of me, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772 or go to the web, yourownhealthandfitness.com. AIDS and vitamin C is more complicated, and you explain that part of the reason it's more complicated is because there is this CD4 lymphocyte that reproduces indefinitely. So what you've suggested in the book is that you need to continue intravenous solutions of vitamin C to extend beyond the lifetime of this CD4, so several months or something, huh?
Yes, and that's probably one of the big differences, not only with AIDS from other viral infections, but separating acute viral infections from chronic viral infections. Certainly, it was established by Dr. Klenner and Dr. Cathcart and many other doctors that, amazingly enough, intravenous vitamin C could rapidly, usually over a 4 to 6 day period, cure acute hepatitis, regardless of the type that it was. But once the hepatitis became chronic, like a chronic hepatitis C, you could have a lot of wonderful effects on the body. You could help control the liver enzymes and keep the inflammation down, but it was less clear cut that extremely high doses of vitamin C could cure chronic hepatitis C, for example. So similarly, in the case with AIDS, we actually know that part of the HIV nucleic acid genome gets incorporated into the nucleic acid of certain immune cells. And in this way, the active agent of the virus can hide, if you will, from not only vitamin C, but from any other factor that you're looking at to help treat or hopefully cure the disease. So in this regard, at least theoretically speaking, you have to continue strong, vigorous therapy well beyond the half-life that these cells would be living, so that when they die and release their nucleic acid, the vitamin C is there to metabolize that and keep it from being infected. So, but having said that, AIDS is relatively unique. Chronic hepatitis is relatively unique. And most infections, acute or chronic, respond very dramatically to vitamin C because it's able to penetrate the tissue so well that most infectious agents typically cannot hide from it.
The other very compelling thing here is the use of vitamin C to protect and treat illnesses we normally vaccinate for with a DTP vaccination, which has been showing up in the news as possibly dangerous, particularly for kids with autism. So being able to avoid the DPT vaccine would be really handy.
Well, yes, and let's say for the bold listener, if you just want to look at the evidence of what vitamin C has done with both diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus, which are the three prongs of DPT, vitamin C has been established in the literature to cure all three of those syndromes. So you have the ability, if you find a willing doctor, to keep any of those conditions once contracted from causing a severe disease to your infant or child. However, if you want to take the point of view of, you know, I don't want to take the chance, I want to take the vaccination, well, that's your prerogative, and based on what vitamin C has been seen to do with toxins, if you take enough vitamin C before, during, and after the vaccination, you can almost certainly avoid the toxic side effects of the vaccination while having the vitamin C enable and amplify the antibody response that you're looking for to the vaccination. So you have a couple of options.
Before we'll go back to this issue, but for now, I'm wondering if you can give people some vague idea of what kinds of doses we're looking at. We've just finished talking about using vitamin C in very extreme situations where it would be given in either in a push, you know, an intramuscular shot to prevent a poisoning reaction, and then intravenous pushes or intravenous dripping slowly. What sorts of amounts, what kind of range of dose are we looking at here?
Well, Dr. Klenner found that for his severest infections, 900 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, so a 150-pound person is 70 kilograms.
Yeah.
70 kilograms times 90, that's 63 grams. So this was the 50 to 75 gram IV dose that Klenner would use acutely in an infection, and he would repeat that dosage 2 to 4 hours later, depending on whether or not the fever responded appropriately. So that wasn't a 24-hour dose, that was a per dose. Nearly all the time, this type of dose would immediately cause a clinical improvement and a lowering of the temperature, and Klenner would rapidly space the dosing out to every 4 to every 6 hours until, as was typically the case, he was completely on top of the illness 48 to 72 hours later. So as a practical point of view, most people with a medium to small size body would do well with most infections by initially taking a 50 gram intravenous dose, that's 50,000 milligrams, and then seeing how they clinically responded. And if they weren't responding very well at all, that would be repeated 2 hours later and every 2 hours until a good response was seen. If, on the other hand, a good response was seen, you could immediately go to a 4-time-a-day or every 6-hour dosing. And this was what Klenner did and had an enormous amount of success. Now, something that wasn't talked about a whole lot in the book, but which Klenner did and is important to understand in the nature of vitamin C therapy, is that Klenner did describe several dramatically ill patients that came to his office that had very little blood pressure, 60 over zero. Those people that know what blood pressure know that's close to death. And these people had just, and in one case it was a toxic spider bite, and this patient was having an anaphylactic reaction to the spider bite, losing blood pressure, and while Klenner was standing over him, the patient was pretty much saying things like, "I'm not sure I'm going to make it, Doc." Under those circumstances, Klenner would just take up pure undiluted vitamin C at roughly a gram per 2 cc's and give IV push vitamin C on the order of 10 to 15 grams, in Klenner's words, as rapidly as a 21-gauge needle would allow. And on all the occasions that he described, the patients had a very rapid recovery. Another patient who was comatose from carbon monoxide rapidly came out of his coma with such an IV push. Same thing with a barbiturate overdose. So there's usually not any indication to go to an IV push as long as you just have the 10 minutes that you need to mix up everything you need and start an IV and do it the intravenous way. But it should be known to the people who are listening, and especially the doctors, that if you're in a truly emergent situation where you think your patient's going to die in the next few minutes, stick your butterfly in and push it undiluted IV push, and you're going to see some amazing things.
Okay. Let's talk about the safety issue with high doses of vitamin C. And what I mean by this is when you look through the literature, which is considerable, there are almost no adverse effects, almost none at all. And then every once in a while, you'll find something. It's very small. And compared to prescription medications, it's laughable how few incidents there are. But because orthomolecular medicine, nutrient medicine, is so under attack, and I thought you had a lot of integrity in this book. You went over in great detail what the possible complications could be and how to avoid them. So let's talk for a moment. Well, let's start with, this is a small one, but let's start with the use of sodium ascorbate. Since sodium ascorbate is used primarily with an IV, and you're also recommending it for oral doses, for optimal doses, and it has the least amount of bowel symptoms. In other words, people are trying to get up to bowel tolerance with their vitamin C, but there's less irritation with sodium ascorbate. What about the fact that because vitamin C has a diuretic-like effect, you've got all the sodium coming in, which is already going to kind of push out some of your minerals and vitamins, then you've got the diuretic effect. Don't you run the risk of pushing the sodium levels too high and then losing all the other minerals as a result?
To my knowledge, that's never been seen and never been described. And as a practical point of view, just from the number of people that I've worked with on vitamin C, family, friends, and a few patients, we've never seen that at megagram doses of mm-hmm. sodium ascorbate. One thing that's important for people to realize when you talk about sodium is in sodium ascorbate is they say, oh, sodium, well, I'm a cardiologist, mind you, mm-hmm. is sodium, oh, I'm supposed to be on a low sodium diet, I've got heart failure, I've got high blood pressure, et cetera, et cetera.
And edema.
Well,
and stuff
that's pressure. Only half true. What should be said is you're supposed to be on a low sodium chloride diet. It's only sodium associated with chloride that expands volume and causes problems with heart failure and high blood pressure, etc. When you have sodium with ascorbate, sodium with bicarbonate, sodium with any other anion, it does not have this effect.
My engineer is a pharmacist, and he's shaking his head, but I don't know what to do about that except to let it lie.
The literature is...
The literature is,
he's free to check the articles themselves. This was researched very extensively by a researcher by the name of Kurtz, who took all the different sodium analogs that I've talked about, as well as sodium chloride, in animal studies and found that sodium chloride was the only one that caused volume expansion, which is what you're trying to avoid when you don't want to have high blood pressure or you don't want to have a heart failure patient get fluid overloaded and have problems breathing. Mm-hmm. Sodium is not the culprit. Sodium chloride is.
Yeah, I tend to believe what you're saying because I've taken sodium ascorbate expecting to see a change in fluid balance in my weight, and I've not seen it. So there are certain circumstances. There was some research that came out that was scolding vitamin C use and saying, look, you know, you put it in a Petri dish with certain things, and it becomes pro-oxidative. It starts causing oxidative damage, and it's going to cause cancer. Well, it's not actually what the researchers said, but that's what everybody else said about the research. There are circumstances under which vitamin C, especially if it's given at low doses, can be pro-oxidative, and it looks as though some of that has to do with when it's interacting with too much iron and too much copper, for instance, and also when it's fighting a major viral or bacterial infection or microbial infection. So can you explain under what circumstances vitamin C becomes pro-oxidative and how to protect people from that?
Yes, and you pretty much touched on it already. But before I go into that, I'd like people to understand that if you're going to have an agent like vitamin C that can destroy a virus, destroy a microorganism, cure an infectious disease, there have to be circumstances under which the vitamin C can be destructive. I mean, the microorganism is protein and nucleic acid, and under these selected circumstances, vitamin C, even though it's completely non-toxic to your tissues under a normal state, is highly effective at breaking down the protein coats on viruses and oxidizing the nucleic acid core that these viruses have. So it is important that there be circumstances and microenvironments under which vitamin C can have a pro-oxidative effect. And that happens, as you said, in microenvironments when there's a low enough dose of vitamin C and a high enough presence of a transition metal, such as iron and copper, through a chemical reaction called the Fenton reaction. The final common pathway is there will be very significant oxidative free radicals that will be generated that are then capable of oxidatively destroying viruses, another protein, another nucleic acids that's present. So when you do this in a test tube and you're able to get vitamin C to destroy the protein or the nucleic acid in the presence of this iron or copper, it means nothing. It absolutely means nothing in terms of what it's doing inside the intact body. All you've done is in a microcosm basically demonstrate why vitamin C is able to selectively kill viruses and bacteria and fungi while not destroying normal tissue. And it has to do with the coexistence of other things such as these transition metals that are present at different times in the tissues. In some infections and in some microorganisms, they specifically have high levels of iron, which make them especially good targets for vitamin C therapy.
So how do we protect patients?
Well, really, in the intact human, as long as you take more than a gram of vitamin C a day, 1,000 milligrams, you virtually completely eliminate any possibility of a pro-oxidative effect. In a very tiny percentage of the population, if you just took 1 or 2 or 300 milligrams of vitamin C a day, then you potentially could be putting just the perfect matching dose of vitamin C with the amount of iron and copper you have in your body to have a slight pro-oxidative effect. But the bottom line is a pro-oxidative effect is what we talked about earlier, oxidative stress. So if you take a large enough dose of vitamin C, there's never a problem of inducing the oxidative stress because you overwhelm this mechanism completely.
Okay, so a little bit is dangerous, a lot is better.
A little bit is going to be dangerous maybe 0.1% of the time.
Very, very small.
For a tiny portion of the population.
Small population. Hemochromatosis people, the people with hemochromatosis or higher iron overload. So. There's a big myth, and it just persists and persists and persists. Kidney stones and vitamin C. Have at.
Well, as I mentioned in the side effects chapter, or the safety chapter, not really the side effects chapter, is that certainly kidney stones are reality. Kidney stones exist, and the kidney stones are generally made up of calcium oxalate. It's true that vitamin C metabolically breaks down to oxalate or oxalic acid. So there's this then possibility that vitamin C could contribute a portion of a kidney stone because it makes one of those components. But then that falls aside when you see that there's well over 60 other things that produce increased oxalate, and they don't necessarily produce stones. The very state of being present causes what's called a hyperoxaluria, or increased oxalate in the urine, yet there's no increased kidney stone incidence in you just because you're pregnant. What happens is, once things break down and a large amount of oxidative stress is present in the urinary tract, people can start precipitating calcium oxalate regardless of the concentrations of these substances. And in fact, in the chapter that we talked about this, two very large studies from Harvard, 50, 60, 70,000 patients in each study, showed that not only does vitamin C not promote the incidence of kidney stones in people taking megagram doses for many years, but it decreases the incidence of kidney stones, number one, and in patients who have previously had a kidney stone, it decreases the likelihood of recurrence. Now, having said this, there's one subset of patients where you have to be careful, not only with vitamin C, but with any other product that makes oxalate, and that is kidney failure patients. Kidney failure patients lack the ability to properly excrete not only oxalate, but all the other solutes that are presented to them. And you need to be much more careful with your dosage and watch your blood work much more carefully. It's not to say that kidney patients shouldn't take vitamin C, not at all. There's a lot of benefit for them, but they're the ones that have to exert a little caution in maintaining good hydration, and in watching blood work and maintaining urine output, and they'll do fine too. And they're really the only subset. Other than that, you really don't have to worry about it.
You have cautioned against the use of too much calcium, that calcium interacting with vitamin C could increase oxalates.
Yes, indeed. I mean, that's another ball of bag of worms there entirely. But in regard to getting these kidney stones, we have an epidemic of calcium supplementation in this country. And most people, because of this calcium supplementation, have turned many parts of their body into rock-like hard calcium deposits. Vitamin C in and of itself can mobilize calcium. It'll help dissolve calcium deposits in different parts of the body, along with other things like vitamin K and magnesium.
We're talking about the deposits that you don't want, not about the bone deposits.
Exactly, exactly. Non-bone deposits in the blood vessels, in the organs where deposits of calcium should not be.
So vitamin D and magnesium.
Not vitamin D.
Vitamin D and magnesium. Huh?
Vitamin K and magnesium.
Vitamin K and magnesium. But I would think that maybe the reason people are downing so much calcium is that they really lack enough vitamin D.
No, not really. Vitamin D does promote the absorption of calcium, but there's a lot of literature out there that shows even the amount of vitamin D that's being routinely added to milk and everything else has led to a substantial increase in calcium deposition and part of the increasing heart disease problem we have today.
No, well, there's a researcher that I've had on my show several times who would disagree with you, who's done the same kind of really complete research on vitamin D and has found this not to be so. You may be thinking of synthetic D2, but Reinhold Wieth, you might type him into your search engine, Reinhold Wieth in Canada, and read some of his papers on vitamin D. But anyway, to move on, so people should just be conservative about how much calcium they take and make sure there's enough magnesium and vitamin K on board.
Well, the Japanese as a population, with their high fermented soy products, get a large amount of vitamin K and will routinely treat their osteoporosis with 40 milligrams of vitamin K.
Yeah, and blow out their thyroids in the same instance, unfortunately.
Well, you have toxicity problems as well.
Yeah,
Anyway,
I want to move on because we have a few other things I want to get to before
sure.
we run out of time. Another situation where you have to be careful with vitamin C is when you have the malaria and sickle cell trait and the G6PD deficiency, which is a very esoteric thing. Maybe we should just leave it for people to read in the book, but in situations where people have sickle cell trait, they should probably read the section on the G6PD deficiency and vitamin C.
Yeah, and as I said, G6PD deficiency, to make it simple, can just any sort of stress can cause the red blood cells to hemolyze or break down. And even though there have been two or three reports in the literature of a G6PD deficient person having one of these red blood cell breakdown crises after taking vitamin C, there are literally probably multiple thousand IV doses of vitamin C given a day now across the world in black populations as well as white and oriental. And in the black populations, there's a substantial incidence of G6PD deficiency, but there haven't been any more reports. So I really think that this is sort of a non-issue. It's an issue, obviously, that's important if it happens to you, but other than in these two or three cases, which all the details were not supplied, so I don't know what other medicines they were taking or other factors were present. I mean, once you get a case report that's, you know, 15 or 20 years old, you're left with the details in the report and you can't get any further information.
Right. Okay.
But it doesn't appear to be a real problem.
Okay. Let's move on to what people can actually practically do now with their vitamin C. Those people who are listening who are not in a severe crisis and about to be wheeled off to an emergency room, or are terribly ill, optimal dosing with vitamin C, the bowel tolerance test. I saw Cathcart actually speak, and immediately after started to come down with a cold, and I did the protocol for the ascorbate effect of taking sodium ascorbate he actually said even every 15 minutes, a half hour. I took it every hour until I reached bowel tolerance. My own experience with this was that it was enormously uncomfortable. I just can't even tell you in detail because it would be too gross. Because as much as you can recover from getting the runs, there's also a lot of irritation that goes on your way there, a lot of gas and things like that. So it was pretty uncomfortable. I think it did sort of back the virus off, but when you talk about bowel tolerance, I really would like you to explain, do you mean that the way to test yourself for bowel tolerance at any given time to find out what your optimal dose is and then, of course, add more if you think you're getting sick for a period of time, is it to do a single high dose and see if that produces a diarrhea, or do you just keep upping your dose until you get the runs?
Well, no. Generally, as a practical point, you want to take 3/4 to 1 level teaspoon, which is 3 to 4 grams, every half an hour until you get the diarrhea effect. The other thing, when you start taking it over a more extended period of time, like every hour, and it's a large dose you're taking every hour, there's more time for the gas to build up. When you take it on a shorter time frame, you'll get the diarrhea effect before you start getting an overwhelming gas problem. Having said that, I'll also say that Dr. Hal Huggins did the C-Flush for a long time, and he would also sprinkle a little activated charcoal inside the C-powder. That appeared to significantly decrease gas formation if this was especially a problem for a given patient, because definitely not everybody has that particular problem, but it usually is going to happen when you're taking it over a much more prolonged period of time with longer intervals building up than if you hit it, like I said, every half an hour until you get the effect. But having said that, it's a very gross way, a very approximate way to determine your bowel tolerance. Most people, after they started taking their vitamin C for a few weeks, have a pretty good idea if they're taking in the 6 to 9 to 12 to 15 gram a day range, that there's a certain level at which they do start to get a little bit of rumbly in the stomach, not necessarily all going all the way to a diarrhea, and that they could back off a gram or two and then have a fairly comfortable dosage to take on a daily basis. So most people, if they don't want to bother with all of that, if you just want to do a one-dose-fits-all, which I don't necessarily recommend, but rather than just take a very small dose of C a day, try to take at least something along the line of 6,000 milligrams, say 2,000 milligrams 3 times a day.
Okay.
And most people are going to tolerate that.
Okay. We're completely out of time. I've got to let you go. Can you give us a quick answer for why you're not in Asia right now using vitamin C on SARS?
Well, we've been making an attempt to go over there, but it's just
really
not
quagmire.
Just not a simple situation.
Okay. Well, we hope you get there. Thank you so much for your time and your interview, Dr. Thomas E. Levy, L-E-V-Y, M.D. and lawyer, Vitamin C, Infectious Diseases and Toxins, Ex Libris Press at 1-888-795-4274, or go to exlibris.com. Thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you.
I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, you can call my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.com. Next week, a show called Health and Micronutrient Supplementation. I will pick up from where we left off on this show and talk about what suggestions I might have for you on how to keep yourself healthy. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness in Sebastopol at the Powerhouse is George Curtis. Thanks to Johnny Otis in the Powerhouse.